This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
Hello, Hearts of Oak, and welcome to another interview coming up with Dwight Schultz, Howling Mad Murdoch from the A-Team. He came in on audio. Dwight hasn't done interviews for years. I was absolute delight to have him on when you talk to one of your childhood heroes who you grew up watching him in A-Team. And he was my favorite simply because he was a pilot and I always wanted to grow up. And that's what I wanted to grow up to be. But I'm talking to him about being a conservative, being a Christian in the industry, in Hollywood, in the movie industry. And actually, we delve more deeply into his Christian faith, Roman Catholic background, and what it means for him to be a Christian in that industry where you're pulled every way and where your faith is ridiculed, mocked, and everything stands against that. So great conversation about some of his experiences and what it is to be a Christian and to be a conservative in the industry. We talk about his voiceovers. I mean, his voice is legendary. Talk about that and why I stepped away from doing kind of in front of a camera in 2001, why that was, and all the voiceover. And then I think 100 video games. His voice is in whole other world, whole other industry. So I know you will enjoy listening to Dwight as much as I enjoyed speaking with him. It is wonderful to have Dwight Schultz with us today. Dwight, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Peter, for my reintroduction to the world of podcasting, radio, television.
Thank you. This is something I've only been doing 3 years, so I know you have much more experience back in the day, but we'll get into some of that. And obviously, I remember you fondly growing up. I think I was six whenever the A-Team first came out, which is now 40 years ago. I'm sure I didn't watch it when I was six. but your role, obviously, is as Howling Mad Murdoch. So we can take just a little bit memory lane before we go into and talk about actually being a conservative in the industry and what that is like. But, I mean, it ran for five seasons, 83 to, I think, 87. Do you just want to let us know how you actually ended up in that role?
Well, actually, it actually only went four seasons, real seasons. So it's not technically considered a success. That's true. I ended up in that role because I made a comedy tape at the Williamstown Theater Festival around 1979, okay. 1980, somewhere in there. And the comedy tape, I for 2 years, I didn't hear anything. And then suddenly I started getting calls from my agent to audition and to go to Los Angeles to audition. And it was because of this comedy tape. And I found out it had been making the rounds for 2 years. And eventually Steve Cannell and Frank Lupo, his co-writer, saw it and requested me to come. Joel Thurm, who was the vice president of NBC at the time, however, he had different ideas about this character. And anyway, I went in and they flew me out to Los Angeles. And my wife was out here. She wasn't my wife at the time, but I had been dating her since 79. And she was out here living in Los Angeles, which was difficult. I mean, I was glad to come out here for any reason. And I had never... It was a joy, but I came in and I auditioned and it was a total flop. It was a bomb. I mean, you walk into a small room with 25 people, 30 people, and there was not a single laugh. There was nothing. There was no Twitter. And then they sent me out and they sent the director, Rod Holcomb, out with me to talk to me. I came back in. I did the same audition and everybody was laughing and I had no idea why they were laughing now and they weren't laughing before unless someone said laugh when he comes back in. You know, that's the way it was. It was just an astonishing thing. And they said, you got the part. And then, and this is the really, this is the nub, right? So they shoot in Mexico, and I went down to Mexico. When we were down there, I was fired. Okay. I was fired. Rod Holcomb came into my little room, and he said, "I'm afraid it's not going to work out." And I said, "Oh, what?" He said, "It's not Steven. It's not Frank. It's the would-be's at NBC. They just don't think you're quite right for it." And so they took me out of my little room, and they put me in with the stuntmen, who I loved. I was just loved them. I mean, it was incredible to work with these guys. And so there I was with the stuntmen for the rest of the shoot down in Mexico. And when we came back to the States, they were editing it and putting it together as we were shooting it, right? I got a call from my agent, said, "Your dials were great." I said, "What are you talking about?" I had no idea what they were talking about. This is 82, right? This is 1980. I don't know what you're talking about. He said, the dials, the testing, the audience loved you. You're the best dials that anybody had. So I was written back in.
Oh.
I was rehired before I was fired. And so you can't make this stuff up in life. You can't. So it just turns out that they had a different view of what this character should be like, and I had another view. And Stephen Cannell and Frank Lupo were in my camp, and so they had to write me back into the first five episodes, which they had kind of written me out of. And that's the way it started. And I was, as anybody would be, you know, I got to work with some of the finest old actors that I had grown up with in the 50s and 60s. And it was a thrill. The 4 years were a thrill. I mean, it was an absolute thrill. And I got along beautifully with everybody. And Stephen J. Cannell was a conservative. I mean, I'm lucky. I'm fortunate there. Yeah, I was fortunate because some of my other experiences were not so fortunate working with people who knew I was a conservative and weren't going to have a conservative on their show. That was the way it started back then. Wow. But anyway, so it was 4 years we didn't really have a studio. We were working on locations, and I got along famously with everybody, and it was a joy. It was believe me, it changed my life completely and totally. I never thought I would end up in Los Angeles and never leave.
It's intense, I guess, that you're living and breathing it. And most people, I have no idea what that's like. Most people go to a job and they go home, but you're there nonstop. What's that kind of intensity, especially 4 years with it's the same people?
It's the same people. But listen, as an actor, I mean, I've been working professionally since 1969. This gives it's over 50 years, right? So I have. Before the A-Team, I never knew what my next job was, ever. I never knew what I was doing next. And after the A-Team, I never have known what I'm going to do next. I've never had a consistent job other than those 4 years. And I thank God for them every night. I hoped it would go longer, but this was not the intention nor the background of Stephen J. Cannell. His shows, were 2 years, 3 years. And then they moved. Every single writer that we had in the first year moved on to their own series. They all became producers. And this is not the way you have a successful series for an actor, which is selfish, right? You want to go at least 5 years, 7 years. But they all, you have to have somebody there who is consistently behind it, pushing it, making sure everything is the way it's supposed to be. But that was not the way it was. But I did everything that you can possibly imagine, I think, on that show. And as the 14-hour days, 15-hour day, I loved it because I knew that there was going to be an ending.
Yeah.
I knew the day I started that there was going to be a last day. And so, and I think that's the way life is, actually.
No, exactly.
You know? Yeah. And so take advantage of what you have and enjoy it and hope for the best. But I savored every minute. And I look back very fondly.
When you say it wasn't a success, I mean, I remember thinking this is the biggest thing ever. This is phenomenal. Well, watching it as a kid growing up, and so it did seem to be the kind of TV show that you would watch. I mean, the only other one I remember at the same time was, I think it was Knight Rider on the same time, but they were the shows to watch.
Yes, they were, but you see, we were on NBC, Grant Tinker and Brandon Tartikoff, and their moniker was quality programming. Yep. And Grant Tinker and, well, Tartikoff gave an interview for the New York Times, right? This is not an example of our quality programming, right? Really, this is it. Right? That's what he said. You know, their ideas was Hill Street Blues, which they had on. This was their idea of quality programming, not this schlock that's number one, you know. This is not it. And I sent Grant Tinker a telegram, and George Papard said, "Don't do it, pal. Don't do it. Don't do it," Papard said to me. I sent it to him, and I said, this is third-rate executiveship. I said, we do the best work we can, and we're number one. Why are you doing this to us? And then he sent me a telegram back, which I have kept, saying, "Well, you're assuming that that was true, what you read it in." And I said, "Well, I checked with the writer, the journalist, quote unquote, who he said he talked to you, and this is what you said." And indeed, he did. And in a this isn't tag to all of this. He, after the show was over, it was canceled several years afterwards. I have received a phone call from his assistant saying Brandon wants to talk to you. And I said, sure, I'll talk to him. And I met with him in this basement office, 20th Century Fox. And I walked in, and there was nobody there but Brandon Tartikoff sitting at a table, and he apologized to me. His daughter had been in a very serious accident, and changed his life. You know, it was one of these things. And he apologized to me. I'll never forget it. And, you know, this does not happen in show business.
Yeah.
It does not happen. And I said, yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for that. I said, and then I went into my spiel about being an actor and that you know, you do the best job you can, whether you're doing Shakespeare, whether you're doing Shaw, whether you're doing the A-Team.
Yeah.
You do the best job you can. It is the same job if you're good and you love your work. It doesn't matter. You do the best thing, the best you put. You're not walking through it. And I said, that's what we were doing, and we happened to be number one. And why did you rain on the parade? You know, I asked him. And he gave me some explanations as to the exigencies at the top of a TV network. And so at any rate, that's the experience. That's the beginning and end of that experience, really. And I carry it with me.
How did you cope with that fame? I mean, you were, what, 30, 32? So
32,
you weren't young, but still, when you're thrust into that level of publicity, how did kind of that affect you personally, and how did you cope with that?
Well, you know, I was fortunate in that I had been working since 69. I spent 13 years in regional theater. I spent, you know, years in New York, three Broadway plays. I have had a lot of experience, really, you know, they walk in the boards, doing all the grunt work, getting there. And fame was not a... I was known, and all my interests in theater were to be, this is a joke actually, but never the same actor twice. I mean, that's it. You didn't want to do the same thing. And here I was. And I forced the idea that this actor, this character would be different in each episode, which the vice president of NBC said, that's not the way you cone your hair differently. You should be the same. We want you to be polite on this. And I said, no. I don't want to do that. I want to be different in every show. And so I maintained, I think, because of the work that I had had, being able, when you do the classics, when you're in, and I don't mean this, when you have the great opportunity to play a Shakespearean role, you understand something about talent, about what goes into writing, brilliant writing, and then schlock writing. I mean, you see it all. And when you've been given that opportunity, there's a humility that hits you. You know, so fame was never something that I wanted. I wanted to be able to, and I've had this ability. I've been able to go to a department store or take my daughter to a mall and not be recognized, which is, I'm telling, I worked with Paul Newman, and Paul Newman he wow. told me he couldn't go anywhere. He was a prisoner of his fame.
Yeah.
George Peppard was a prisoner of his fame. The closest I think I've ever gotten was somebody said, your voice sounds familiar. Do you know my brother? And I'll say, no, I don't know your brother. And then every once in a while, somebody recognizes you, but it's a curse. It is a curse, really. If you have a family, if you want a family life, if you want privacy, which I think is necessary for survival in this business. I mean, I've seen a lot of actors drop to their knees and open cardboard tubes and pull drugs out.
Yeah.
You know, and that's fame. And you ask them, that's it. It's driven. You know, you gotta have that fame. And it's not what I wanted. I really am a repertory actor. That's it. I'm a repertory actor. I spent 1 year in Houston, at the Alley Theater in Houston, and it was one of the greatest years I've ever had. And I never wanted to leave. And someone told me that's why you have to leave.
Yeah.
I would have stayed there. I could have stayed there. But my agents all told me, you have to leave. You can't stay here or your career will be over. Mm. And I said, but I love this. And they said, you won't love it when it dries up there. You know, you have to go to a bigger yard in essence, but I'm really a repertory actor. That's it. And,
I mean, your last TV role was 2001. I will get into the voice side a little later, but your last 2001. Why did it end there? Was it personal experience? Was it just choice?
Oh yeah, no, it was really a personal experience. It was CIA. It was 2001. Was I went in for wardrobe fitting, and we were at the Memorial Cemetery, Veterans Cemetery down in Wilshire Boulevard, and that's where it was being shot. And I walked in, and this is nothing. I won't mention the name. I shouldn't have even said what the show was. Just that someone in the wardrobe room.
Yeah.
We were talking about 9/11. We were talking about what had happened in New York. I had a lot of friends in New York, of course, obviously. And she said, I don't have any connection to that. I don't know why everybody, I just don't have any connection to it. You know,
wow.
Just no connection. Wow. And she rubbed it off, you know, and I said, life was, roles were at that point not easy to come by, actually. And I said, I can't do this. You know, I can't work. This to me was a sign from God. I'm not joking. You look for these things. This was a sign that this was the wave of the future. And there was going to be a lot of denial, and there was going to be, and it's complicated. I mean, I'm not judging anybody. But for me, it was I had an opportunity to move into another direction, and I decided to do the other direction because I could be anybody, anything in voiceover work. And video games were just becoming big at the time, and the whole business was very big. And voice work was something that, as an actor in the theater, I always did. If I couldn't find the voice of the character, I couldn't find the character. Mm-hmm. And so that was it. I mean, the fates came together at that time. Mm. And I was doing radio at the time on a fairly regular basis with a friend named Don Ecker. I just moved in that direction, you know. And there were opportunities there, but I knew things had changed at that point.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into that. I want to pick on being a conservative in the the movie and TV industry, and that seems to be opposites. We've seen more and more, and I think it probably gets worse. And you're Roman Catholic, you're conservative.
Yes.
What has been your experiences having a faith and also having a conservative belief? How does that fit into the showbiz industry? What has it been like for you?
Well, going back, it's if you look at if you look at the world that we're in today, the Judeo-Christian world, which is, and I have to say, if I have one criticism of modern Christianity prior to today, and I mean going back,
yeah,
because there's a lot of things I could say about today. Which we will, I'm sure. But one of the things which always struck me was about Christians was their antipathy for the Old Testament, the Torah. It is Judeo-Christianity. And if a Christian doesn't understand that the Old Testament is their testament, there's a problem. And they don't, indeed. In Bible study, the number of times that I heard Christians say, "Oh, that's not my God. I want to get out of this. I want to get to my God." Yeah. You know, well, that's two gods. There is the Trinity, which is three gods in one, right? I mean, we do have that mystery, but we are monotheistic.
Yep.
And the Christ's Old Testament was his Old Testament. He was here to fulfill the Old Testament. This is what he said. That it is the Father. You're speaking of your Father. This is Christ's Father, and the Torah, the law, as it was laid down, is your law. It went on to the New Testament. You know, and Catholics, I mean, I was raised a Catholic, and when I found out that it wasn't thou shalt not kill, but thou shalt not murder,
yeah,
you know, you know, the wheels begin to turn, and you try to think as best you can about these things. But it's there was a disconnect between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and that has to do with my criticism of my own faith. In motion pictures, in the film industry, it was under attack. As it is today, Christianity is, and Judeo-Christian ethic, the West, everything that has been built through the Judeo-Christian ethic is under attack, and they want to destroy it.
Yeah.
And basically at the very front of that is the communist wagon, and it always has been. And you can go back to 1918 or whatever and read about it. And they tried every which way from Sunday to do it, and they always failed. And now they've found another way of doing it. And they have succeeded by going after our children when we didn't know they were going after our children. But as Christians, we're pretending that it wasn't important to be mothers and fathers. And the nuclear family really wasn't that important. Well, then why were they trying to destroy it? And why has it been number one? Because I'm going to say something else here in a second, which I'm pointing to. There's a this quote. This is the technique that they have used, and you didn't know it, but you felt it all along. You felt this, but you didn't know it. A quote by it's attributed to Oscar Wilde, and I think it is his. I think it is his quote. Mm. And it is pithy and accurate and brilliant and beyond belief descriptive of everything. Everything in the world is about sex, except sex. Mm. Sex is about power.
Mm.
And boy, when I read that, I said, is this, did he really say this? Is it? And it hit me from every direction. The entertainment business in every which way is about sex.
Yeah.
Novels, books, television, commercials, life itself, clothes. It's all about sex. And it goes back to God's edict to humanity. Go forth and multiply. This is the power of procreation, is sharing in the power of creation. That power was given to all of us. We don't know. I mean, people have talked about it, but we don't know where that came from, except from God. And it is something to, what do we do with these gifts? Do we throw them away? Or do we say these are precious? And you see by the people that you meet, those who recognize the gift and those who don't recognize the gift. And you are asked not to recognize it on a daily basis. And as a child, if you think back to your childhood, when sexual urges, whether you're, of course, I can't tell you what a woman goes through, but I can only tell you what a kid goes through. Boy, when you're going through puberty, the whistles and gongs are going off, and you know, you're having dreams at night and you can't stop it. You know, everything is at the wrong moment, and you're not purposefully thinking about it, but it's a force to be reckoned with. And you understand it as you grow older, that this force is to bring you to someone else, to love, to have a family, and to create the next generation. And then everything changes after that. If you can contemplate that greatness, that extraordinary thing, and realize that the world seems to want to distort it, well, then you realize the powers that are set up against Judeo-Christianity. And who say that we don't want the Ten Commandments, we don't want that Old Testament rag, we want freedom, free life. And of course, I went through that in the 60s and 70s in school, and I saw it. I mean, I was part of it, in that it bounced off of me at every moment. And being a Christian, you stay in it.
Hmm.
I stayed in my Christianity. When I got to college. I mean, I had 12 years of Christian education, right? I wanted to be an actor, and I went to a Towson University, which had a great theater program, and it was the first time that I was in a purely secular environment. Hmm. The thing that killed me was that everybody hated their parents. Everybody hated their parents. I mean, sure. Nobody wanted to. Nobody had a good thing. I loved my parents, and I used to say, I had a long bus ride home, and I used to sit in the bus looking out the window saying, why do I love my parents and I can't find somebody who loves their parents? What is that? Well, I can't say that I answered the question, but the answer was in the destruction of the family. It was in the destruction, and it had started then. Not my mother and father. Here's the next aspect, and I think that this plays a very big part in all the trouble we're having today. I never wanted to do something that shamed my parents, that they would be ashamed of. Yeah. I felt shame. I still do. I feel shame. It was given to me by my mother and my father.
Mm.
Now, none of us are perfect. I know my mother wasn't perfect. My father wasn't perfect. I'm not perfect, but I feel shame. And shame is rare. Now, look, I was listening to your podcast with Father Calvin Robinson, right?
Goodness, you make me blush.
No. And no, but he said something. he said something about the about drag queens in the sacristy. I mean, yep. in the sanctuary. I mean, we're talking about there is no shame if you do that. Shortly after, I guess we communicated. I went to here in Los Angeles. I went to the Church of the Nazarene in Pasadena, and I saw two. I don't know if you know these individuals, Dennis Prager. Do you know Dennis Prager?
Yeah.
Dennis is a Jewish scholar. I've been following him since 1982 when I came to Los Angeles. He had a program called Religion on the Line. One of the great minds and thinkers of all time. In fact, many times after listening to him, I would say to myself, "I'm a Jew. That's what I am. I'm a Jew." And then there's Eric Metaxas,
yeah,
who is a Christian writer, thinker. And these two were in a program, an evening called Ask a Gentile, Ask a Jew. And it was a great evening, 2 hours of just two brilliant people talking about the state of religion. What was the final outcome, sad outcome of the evening? Metaxas and Prager both came to the conclusion that organized religion has failed us. It has failed us. The churches and the synagogues have failed us. They have not stepped up to defend their own dogma, their own beliefs, and we are left flailing, individuals almost, and we are struggling to connect, which is what you and I are doing right now. And I was dumbfounded by that. But at the same time, that's what I'm thinking. It's what I've been thinking for quite some time. And all of these things, you know, we are under attack from every direction. And it, in your own mind, what do you do? Do you throw it away? Do you say, well, maybe I'm thinking the wrong thing? No, that is not the case. Because when you think about why our children, and if you've seen this now, why our children are being told that they don't know what their sex is. Metaxas brought this up in the evening, that this is one of those key cardinal points you can see.
Yeah.
This is a perversion of reality, because you know what the truth is. If you have a Supreme Court justice, as we do in the United States, who says, I can't define a woman, and that children, 10-year-old children, 11 and 12-year-old children, secretly, don't tell your parents, the hallmark of a lie, keep it secret, don't tell anybody, don't even tell yourself. You know, the hallmark of concealment, consciousness of guilt, everything that you know is, they are trying to tell you, you know nothing, and everything you know is not to be believed, but they are to be believed, that children, there are not boys and girls, that men can give birth, that there are, you know, these things that we, it's incomprehensible what's going on, and it's all to destroy right from wrong.
Well, that, because it's kind of, I look at it a different way. One is the difficulty of living in a society where evil is slightly different, where it's a slippery slope, and it may be difficult to distinguish what you believe with something that's slightly different. But we see such a chasm now between what is true, what is right, and the collapse and degradation of society. So in theory, that means it is easier to be a Christian, because it's easy to be distinct, because what you face is the opposite of what you believe. And that's why it's curious and interesting to see churches going down this line whenever there's there's no question of what we see is the opposite of what is written in scripture.
Oh, there's no question. You know, what you're saying, you can be crushed, you know, you can be crushed. At the same time, you have to deny so many things to accept what's going on. And then, and yet you say to yourself, how do I stop it? The war that's going on in Europe at this moment. And this is why I love Bannon. I adore him. Andrew Breitbart brought me out of the closet politically, really politically. I was doing a lot of things, and but saying a lot of things that were in the basket. But he truly brought me out.
When was that?
When was this?
Yeah.
This is through Gary Sinise and Friends of Abe. This is in the, I have to say, I'd say 2000, okay. 2005.
Okay.
2006. By 2008, I have to say around 2005, 2006. I was like a Jew wandering in the desert alone and wondering where God was. And a friend of mine who I worked with on Fat Man and Little Boy, a film about making the atomic bomb, called me up. His wife was a casting director. And he said, you know, there are conservatives just like yourself who get together on a regular basis. And I said, no, I did not know that. He said, would you like to go to a meeting? I would love to go to a meeting of other people. And so I went, and it was Gary Sinise and Andrew Breitbart and a lot of other extraordinary people who were all, and this is it, seeking, you know, trying to make connections. And Andrew said, you have to become public. He had big Hollywood and big, you know, had all of these big websites. Mm-hmm. And he asked me to write an article. He heard me in private describe a situation that I was in, in which I was at the Williamstown Theater Festival. I had just come back from working with Charlton Heston. And I had a long discussion, which was just a wonderful discussion, in the hallway at the Amundsen Theater. About Ronald Reagan becoming president, right? And this individual who was is a big producer in Hollywood overheard me talking about Ronald Reagan. And he said, oh, so you're a Reagan a-hole, you know? And yeah, that's right. That's right. And I said, This was a big guy at the theater too that I was working at. And I went cold. I went cold. I said, yes. I said, you know, not as a, you know, and I pulled back. I was, you know, he was attacking me, obviously, with his language. And I was shocked. I was totally numbed. And I didn't want to continue with this discussion because otherwise there would have been a blowout. But that was how in 78, 80, I understood that there was this chasm, you know, there. And it only got worse as time went on. And as I said, fortunate, it is not a zero-sum game. Fortunate there was, for me, and I did have an audition for this particular, this producer. There was a writer there who was a brilliant writer. We had a fallout, but he's just an extraordinary writer. His name is Tom Fontana. He wrote St. Elsewhere, producer, writer for St. Elsewhere, The Wire, many wonderful programs. And he did not know about this problem that I had and invited me to read for a part called Fiscus in St. Elsewhere. And I walked in and there was this producer who has passed away since now. And Breitbart wanted me to write about him. And I did, and I regretted it, but I don't regret it. But anyway, so I walked in, and he was there, and he said, "Oh, what are you doing here?" And to this audition, and I said, "I'm here to read for the part of Fiscus." He said, "It's not going to be a Reagan blank hole on my show." So you know what that audition was like, right?
Wow.
You know, I mean, and I walked out, and I said, "God, is this going to be it? You know, is this the way it's going to be?" And at any rate, so I finally did write this article about him, and I lost a lot of friends for writing it. And then at the same time, and I was one of the first actors for Breitbart to use my name. This was what he wanted, because a lot of pseudonyms, writing for big Hollywood, and which I understand. Please, so I did not do this. I did this for personal reasons, but not because I'm brave or anything of that nature. I just was at the point where I was going to tell the truth. This is the way it's done. And you are excluded on a cocktail napkin, and that cocktail napkin is sent around to other producers, and you're excluded. It is not a zero-sum game, because there was Stephen J. Cannell, and he hired me. But the majority of people will not, unless, of course, you bring in $30 or $40 million over a weekend.
Yeah,
and then they'll hire you. But the attack on Judeo-Christianity, the attack on conservatism, which is a hallmark of Judeo-Christianity, is now at its height. This is it's never been greater than it is today.
Well, and, you're obviously being a Christian, being a conservative within an industry, within the workplace, but then you had your podcast, you mentioned Breitbart on the Glasoff Gang. That's something different. You're stepping outside, and actually you're much more public. I mean, was that a conscious decision to actually begin to use radio, use the internet, use TV, and speak of these issues as a Christian and conservative?
Yes, absolutely. And the reason for that was I would not, as Murdoch from the A-Team, go out and evangelize. I wouldn't go out as Murdoch from the A-Team, vote for, right? You're taking something that is not related, and you're trying to use it to get somewhere where it's not as, to me, as honest as separating yourself out, creating a podcast, creating another world. This is where I talk politics. This is where I talk my personal life, my personal beliefs. This is where I do it. And so you come to me, and then we go out from there. And I associate with people who talk about religion, and I associate with people who talk about politics, and I talk it there in that realm. There's obviously a mixture. You can't divorce yourself from who you are and what you've done, and I don't. But I've never hidden my religion. I've never hidden my Christianity, as some people do. That's not the way to do it either. Yes, I am a Christian. I'm a Judeo-Christian. I believe in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And it's, for me, not a contradiction in terms. And so I express it that way. I express it here on my own podcast when I had it. And if ever anybody wanted to talk about it, I was willing to do it. And I attended every event, and with Jamie and the lovely Annie Cyrus, that was just wonderful. That was absolutely wonderful. And I went to a David Horowitz retreat, which is where I met Jamie. And I had the great fortune, an opportunity to speak, right, at a Freedom Concert event. And many of my public heroes were there from various political websites. and I got to meet them, and I and that's where I met Jamie, and he invited me on to engage with him on his program, the Glazov Gang. Okay. Yeah. Glazov Gang. It's so funny. But, you know, and I met just so many fabulous people. There are so many things right now, which I see things now and can talk about things that I couldn't prior to coming out with Andrew. And that of course is Bannon's big thing. Andrew, I mean, he's, Andrew changed, just brought the world together. I mean, his vision, his understanding of what was really going on was unique. And he was right into, he was dead on about everything. And I still don't agree with most of his friends. I have very dark feelings about what happened to Andrew, even though I know he had a heart problem. But you know what I'm talking about. And I don't want to get into that aside, like, but I know the darkness that's out there, and a voice like his had to be stopped. And they don't stop at anything. They don't. And we have now been witness to it in the United States for 5 or 6 years. Nothing stops them. Nothing. And they will lie to your face. They do not care. They're because they are the voice of something that is dark.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not a knife you feel in your back. That's me scratching it. Oh, but I feel blood. No, that's not blood. You know, that's it. That's it.
Can I finish off with ask your voice? Now, it is always wonderful to have a guest coming on, and the sound is absolutely beautiful, crystal clear. You're coming through. Obviously, your voice is how you make your living now, and you've moved away from being kind of in front of a camera to doing voice. Tell us what that is like, because it means, you talked about fame, and that means you're not recognized. It is your voice. And I remember watching, you were the one who, again, using your voice in all different ways, even back as in the A-Team. But tell us about kind of how that works in the industry.
Well, in the industry, it doesn't. You had to be very fortunate. One of the first casting directors I ever met was Sylvia Gold, was her name. And she met with me. My first agent introduced me to her. And she said, "Oh, darling," she said, "you don't understand. No one wants to hear that stuff. That's in the theater. We want to hear you. They want to hear your voice. It's your voice that's important." And I said, "No, it's not." I said, "That's not how I'm a vampire. I'm a thief. I listen to other people. I'm a mathematical idiot. And God gave me this ability to hear people's voices." And I said, "I remember being 7 years old. I was about 7 years old. And I remember the first impression I ever did, which was James Mason in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea at a line. It was, I'm dying now, and the Nautilus is dying with me, breathing as him. And I said this out loud to myself, I am dying now, and the Nautilus is dying with me. And the more I did it, the closer I got. And I would spend time, and I became an Anglophile, and I started listening to Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole. And I found that if I put headphones on, their voice came from the middle of my head, and I could steal from them. I could do impressions of their voice, and even if it wasn't perfect, it became another voice, another character. And I began to identify with my relatives that way. I started doing impressions of my relatives, and they did not like it. And I started doing impressions of my teachers at school, and the kids liked it, but the teachers didn't like it if they heard it. And that's how it started. And I just had an ear for people's voices and dialects in the United States. And that's it. And, in terms of, well, if I'm coming across crystal clear, that's because somebody recommended this microphone, the Heil PR40, which is a dynamic microphone. Most people are wedded to very expensive condenser mics. Yeah. But this is a rejection, you know, it's a cardioid. People can open the door and come into the room and you won't hear it. Mm. You'll just hear me. And Art Bell used this mic, and he was always extolling the virtues of this mic. And I listened to him, and it's inexpensive, comparatively speaking. So it's available. But I have spent years studying and recording people's voices, and listening to them, and trying to reproduce them. And one of the great thrills in my life was I knew somebody who was intimately involved with Laurence Olivier, Peter Schaffer, and he wrote Amadeus, right? And he was just an absolutely spectacular man, and he gave me the play Amadeus to read before it was on Broadway and in Great Britain. And he was just sweetheart of all sweethearts anyway. So I went into a bathroom and I did my impression of Olivier doing the Othello chamber scene. And I gave it to someone who was with Peter and asked them to listen to it to see if I caught any of it. And he said, this friend said, Schaffer listened to it and said, well, he said, if Larry was very, very sick, but it was, it was one of those, I can't repeat anything that I've ever done myself, but I think I listened to the chamber scene from Othello, Olivier's Othello, 1,000 times, that's how you learn when you're a young kid. That's how you learn. And you say, oh, my God, every comma. I followed it along, and he followed the text. Amazingly, he followed the text and was dead on, you know. And those are the kinds of things that, I became very attuned to people's voices and recorded them. And I have a lot of recordings, and I still listen to Burton's Hamlet. And Gielgud, of course, directed it, and it was considered a disaster on Broadway. But there's some great. To capture it. It is a miracle that I can sit here and listen to people who have passed away as if they're in my room. It is a miracle, a technical miracle, but a miracle. Or listening to the great choruses. Motion picture choruses, and from 1958 and 60, and I listen to these grand voices, and I say, most of these people are not here now, but I'm listening to them, and I get emotional about it, you know. So, anyway,
but you've also embraced just finally about I think I looked through, and you'd done the voice for like 100 video games. I guess that's just if you're. You're good at something, then that can be used across different industries.
And they video games are bigger than motion pictures now. And the hardest thing I was ever asked to do, and we were asked to do this periodically, you know, they're these great actors, right? Sir Ian McKellen or Patrick Stewart, right? Those two individuals, I do impressions of both of them. To do them in the same thing. They were an X-Men, right?
Yeah.
So I can't do them because they're so close. They can't make it to do a pickup, right? Yeah. So they ask an actor to come in and do a line, half a line. That's it. I can't do Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart at the same time. But I can't do it because they're too close, and yet they're different. But I have not been able to. I mean, you know, Ian McKellen with Bilbo Baggins, and I was just called the essence. And Patrick has done it Patrick is down there too, but I can't do them together. I cannot do them together. I have to do them separately. And Patrick is, he was a delight, by the way. Mm. Very liberal. Yeah. But one of the great things about Star Trek is my greatest experience that I've had in Hollywood, because there was little to no politics on that set, and everybody was a delight to work with. Everyone, absolutely everyone. And walking around on the great Paramount lot was a thrill. Anyway, sorry, I'm getting sidelined. Yeah. I loved all those people. I did. I really did.
Dwight, I so appreciate you coming on. It's absolutely wonderful to speak with you and hear about your experiences in the industry. So we really do appreciate your time today.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I am very grateful. It's been a long time since I've done anything like this. So,
maybe it'll become more regular.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Thank you so much, Dwight. Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list, donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.